Welcome to the Office Oddcast, where Chris, me, and Kristen will talk about odd things in the office. This is our second episode, and we are going to talk about fan theories for the show. This is brought to you by Yeet Trivia. You can find it on Facebook and Eventbrite. So the first theory I want to talk about today is one that you might have heard and that you might not have heard. And if you have heard it, this could be some consolation because it has been acknowledged and accepted by the writers. The fans have asked if Tom Peetz was the reason to start recording The Office or the people of The Office. Tom Peetz, if you'll recall, was the person who wrote in the suggestion box about depression and suicide, and then Phyllis gave the say that he offed himself. And so the theory is that once he killed himself, that became an open position in the Dunder Mifflin business. And Ryan was able to be hired through the temp agency. And the film crew wanted to see what it's like to work in an office of a pepper company in Pennsylvania to sort of find out the psychology of how things operate and what might have caused Tom Peetz's demise.
I mean, It kind of casts a dark shadow on the whole thing, but it does really make sense. It does. I mean, it even Pam pointed out it's a weird subject for a documentary. So I guess that would, but actually maybe I can debunk this, because when they're watching the documentary later in the bar, it just starts normally. It starts the way we see it. Right. And it's never mentioned. And it seems like if that was the catalyst for the doc, they would have started with that backstory. Right.
It's a possibility. But I don't know if we actually get to see, I mean, we definitely don't get to see everything that the audience who's going to be watching An American Workplace on PBS sees. So they might have mentioned it later on, maybe 2 or 3 minutes into it, whereas we just got to the first few seconds. So again, the writers did acknowledge and accept it, so it does seem to be canon now. But I think it's really neat that either the writers wrote that and the fans caught on, or the writers had no intention of it whatsoever, but the fans said, hey, is this plausible? And I guess Ken Kwapis, Greg Daniels, and everybody else said, yeah, actually it is. I thought that was pretty neat.
Okay, well, I mean, if the writer says it's plausible, then I can't really argue it, but it's just kind of sad.
It is a little sad.
It's a little sad. Okay. So I love this theory a little bit. It doesn't exactly track, I don't think. Toby is always concerned about radon in the building. He puts out the little testers that Michael thought was a thing that moved. Yeah. So he puts out the moo cow testers. And also, later, when they're deciding what to do with the surplus, the copier, or the chairs, he mentions again that they should have the air quality tested because of radon and, what, asbestos or something? So the theory is that all the characters kind of get weirder and become more of their character as the show goes on, and this could possibly be caused by radon poisoning. And the only reason I can't follow this theory is because we know that as the show went on, the writers got to write for particular characters more. So they could do more with that character. They could play more with that character. They could imagine that character better. And that's obviously why that happened. But maybe it's because it was radon poisoning. And I wish I had looked up if being weird and hilarious is a side effect of radon poisoning, but maybe it is. I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
I have read this theory, and I'm no doctor either, and BangYourMom69 on Reddit is also not a doctor, but those who present that theory have said that radon does cause psychological and mental damage over time. Now, is it plausible that being exposed to radon and small doses in an office for X amount of hours a day would cause that? I don't know. But it's a fun theory, and they do get weirder. As we've seen before, Kevin in season 1 was just more not dumb. He was just kind of quiet, but he got dumber as it went on. And then even straight-laced Jim started acting weird. And Michael got more erratic. Everybody seemed to have gotten weirder, which, of course, like you mentioned, writing had a lot to do with that. But who's to say that a little radon poisoning didn't mess it up just a little bit and cause them to go a little crazy, lash out irrationally?
Can we touch back on Bang Your Mom 69? Is that like an actual source that you're citing, or is it's like a friend of yours, or just random made up Reddit name?
Yeah, I found it in the bibliography of Wikipedia, actually. That's where we come to these days. No, it's just, if you ever go on Reddit, everybody has these weird names. You know, it's almost like Smoke That Skin Wagon, which you didn't know is a recall for Tombstone. It's a misquote, because in Tombstone, he goes, go ahead, skin that smoke wagon. And then, of course, YouTube being YouTube and Andy saying, you know, smoke that skin wagon. It's awesome that they reference one of the greatest movies of all time in The Office.
Yeah, it's weird. That was actually my nickname in college, too.
Well, then. Now, my next theory that has been brought up is not necessarily relevant, but it is something that people have argued over. And that is whether or not Jim and Pam kissed twice on casino night. Not twice before they got together, simply on casino night, because we do know that Pam kissed Jim at the Dundies when she was drunk. But the theory is that if you watch the end of casino night, they kiss and then they back away and just stare at each other. And then in the opening for Gay Witch Hunt in season 3, they go back to that. And instead of them just staring at each other, Jim says, you have no idea how long I've wanted to do that. So there are two different theories here. One is that they just simply took two different takes, put one take at the end of casino night, the other take at the beginning of Gay Witch Hunt. But the other theory is that Jim and Pam kissed, pulled back, hesitated, and then kissed again, pulled back, and then Jim says, you have no idea how long I wanted to do that. So it's not exactly a who shot first Star Wars kind of thing, but it is interesting to see, hey, did they kiss twice? Did they kiss once? You be the judge on that. I think it was just simply they took from two different takes. But, I mean, it is supposed to be filmed as a documentary, so there are no quote-unquote takes.
So the only thing that makes me feel like this might be true is honestly just my feelings. You had mentioned this to me a few weeks ago, and I'm like, yeah, they did kiss twice. We saw it, didn't we? So, I mean, I feel like maybe that could be true, but I think the more likely explanation for that is that as they're starting the next season, that sets up the baseline for Jim that he's been in love with her a long time. Now, I don't know if they intended on anybody starting from there and watching from there, but maybe it was like a just-in-case thing or some sort of reminder, you know, when it was actually showing on NBC.
Maybe so. All right, so what is your next theory?
My next theory is, okay, so we see in Dinner Party, or we hear in Dinner Party, Michael alludes to the fact that Serenity by Jan is not making any money yet. So Jan has lost her job. She is broke. She is obviously having some sort of midlife crisis or something. She's moved in with Michael. So
enough said.
And
blew it on herself like a dying star.
She did. She really did. And then we see later she comes into the office and she mentions to Kevin that they used her candles for a vigil for a child that a vigil?
Vigil. V-I-G-I-L.
Where?
Vigil?
Why am I putting use into random shits? Okay. Start over.
Maybe you're British.
Maybe I am. All right. So we know that Jan is having a really hard time in life. And later she comes into the office and mentions to Kevin that they used her candles for a vigil for a girl who had gone missing. The theory is that Jan actually kidnapped a child in order to create a business avenue for herself. And the supporting like evidence from the show is that when Kevin says, oh, thank God they found her, she looks honestly stirred by this news. She's like, oh, they found her? right? And she's like dead on eye lock with Kevin, which it seems like normal Jan would avoid, but she was very interested in that information. What do you think?
So we only get that one piece of dialogue to be able to make that decision. And I'm thinking maybe because of the theory, people see Jan as being appalled or flabbergasted or surprised that they found her. I saw it more as she was nonchalant and just didn't care about the girl. She cared about the candles. So she kind of had to act like she cared. So it's more like, oh, they found her? Kind of, oops, I was caring too much about the candles and not about the girl. So hip, hooray, they found her sort of thing. I didn't get the feeling that she was surprised that they found her kidnapped child. Also, she was never really reprimanded. We see her later on. So if she did kidnap her, kudos to her. This is so weird to be saying this, for getting away with it. Because, you know, there is no evidence that she kidnapped this random girl and sold candles. It seems like a very, very bad business plan, honestly. I think there are better ways to sell your candles. But Jan is a little crazy. Jan goes nuts. She throws a Dundee at a 24-inch TV or however big it is. So Jan's not quite in her right mind. But is she that sadistic? I'm sorry, Bang Your Mom 69. I just don't think that this is an accurate theory.
I love that we're throwing just random facts on this fictitious Reddit character. If that name isn't taken, by the way, when we're done here, I'm going to go get it, but I'm certain that is taken.
It has to be. You're going to have to be like Bang Your Mom 69 42666 or something at this point.
I'm sorry. Is it 1998 and we're on AOL now?
ASL, please.
Yo, chatting was cool when it first happened, man. Chatting was
great. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was the best 15-year-old catfish you'd ever seen. 37, twice divorced, you know, whatever. Didn't matter.
That's how you catfish? You need some new ones, buddy. All right.
I'm getting bit by mosquitoes while we're doing this. I just want to let you know that.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. My next theory is going to come with a warning. I made this up. It's just for fun. There is evidence for it. It's extremely far-fetched, but as far as I know, there's no evidence against it, so I'm a little proud that I was able to come up with it. And this just came up whenever we were in a Facebook group. Somebody said, come up with a ridiculous fan theory and see if it can be busted. And I don't think anybody ever busted it. It's been years since I wrote it, so I don't remember all the comments. But my theory, you ready? Is that David Wallace is the father of Meredith Palmer's daughter. Now, yeah, I know, everybody makes that face. You've got to go past the episodes to catch the first part of it. Now, Meredith did say in one of the episodes that she had another child just so she could get a vacation. But in a webisode in The Accountants, she talks about how she had another child named Wendy. And they asked about what happened with Wendy, and she said that her ex got the good one, which would be Wendy, because she got Jake. So she has two children. We know she has two. One is Wendy, one is Jake. Wendy is never mentioned again, but also David Wallace has two children, and we only get to see one of them. So first, let's talk a little bit about David Wallace. He is a brunette. He is married to a brunette. His son is redheaded. So it's very possible that at some point, even before Meredith or possibly after Meredith, he impregnated a redheaded woman and they had a redheaded child. I'm not that big on how genetics works, but I know two brunettes don't typically make a redhead. Brunette and a redhead, I think, can make a redhead. So I don't think they ever mention the daughter's name in the show. So we don't quite know if it's Wendy or something else. I think if you look in Dunderpedia, they might have named her, but that's just what somebody named her, because it's not in the show at all. But let's go back to it. Now, Meredith has been known to sleep with many people and some of them office workers. That does not necessarily mean that David Wallace was in the office, because we know that she was there before he was CFO. He could have been working somewhere else in Dunder, like in a different position in Dunder Mifflin before then, but he becomes CFO after she's in there. Anyway, so Meredith has been confirmed to have slept with Bruce from Hammermill. She slept with Creed, with Packer, and she offered to sleep with Jim and Michael. And I think that might be it that we know of, but who knows? She gets around. She gets her feel. So it's not against her own morals to have sex with somebody in the office, in case David did, in fact, work there while they were together. And then there is a part whenever they're about to be bought out that everybody goes into the office and they're on speakerphone and Meredith says, "Hey, it's Meredith. By the way, your wife is a very lucky woman." Now, this is where you've got to remember who Meredith is, not just any woman. Not any woman or ex-wife would say something to the extent of, "Hey, your wife is a very lucky woman," if that's your ex. But Meredith is a little different. I think that Meredith would be woman enough to be like, "Hey, I had him. He was great. He's all yours now, and he's pretty dang good. You are a lucky woman." So both of them have two children. We never see the daughter. Teddy's redheaded. David and his wife are not. Meredith is redhead. So all of that combined, plus Meredith has done so many fireable offenses or committed so many fireable offenses and has never been fired. She reveals herself in the office. She's sleeping with the Hammermill rep for coupons and she drinks on the job. She sets her hair on fire at a party and never even gets even a slap on the wrist. These are things that happen whenever the father of your child is the CFO of the company for which you work.
Okay, so presumably if she worked there before he was the CFO, she was doing shit just like that before he was the CFO. In fact, don't we see her doing some asinine stuff like right before we see him as the new CFO? I'm going to look that up.
Maybe. But then again, she's not necessarily caught doing it. I think we've got the part where she like licks the hand sanitizer. But David becomes CFO fairly early. I'm trying to think on which episode that is. It's in season two. Yeah. So really, she hasn't done much because in season one, she's kind of this homely lady that we see. So she really doesn't start doing the antics until after he's CFO. So, you know, thanks for helping me.
Also, I mean, I'm no genetics professor, but I'm pretty sure that if you have, I'm pretty sure that dark hair is the dominant gene. Like if a redhead has a child with somebody who's brunette, the chances of that child coming out redheaded are really small, like tiny.
But it has to. We'll check with Bang Your Mom 69 after this and see what they say. But sure, it could be dominant versus recessive. But I have seen it happen where a brunette and a redhead have had a redhead. So unless maybe something else is going on that I didn't know about. But as far as I know, it is possible. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
So I'm going to reject your theory just because it feels a little icky and makes me like David Wallace a lot less. And I don't want to like David Wallace less than I do now. So there. Okay, so this next theory I like a lot. And it is the theory that Creed is on a very long-term quest for the Loch Ness Monster. Obviously, during Andy's seminar, he gives that whole speech about the Loch Ness Monster and its nipples. And, it's like the butt was not the part in that got me. The nipples, two nipples. Didn't he say two? Doesn't it seem like they would be more like a cat or a, I don't know.
Have you seen Nessie? Do you know how many nipples Nessie has?
I might know how many nipples the Loch Ness Monster has. My only point is that I don't think it's two. Anyway, that's not the theory.
I don't think reptiles have nipples.
We're not theorizing about the number of nipples on the Loch Ness Monster. We are theorizing that Creed is on a quest for it. So the speech during the seminar, the incessant need to scuba dive, like what has this all been for if I can't scuba? and asking Jim how long he can hold his breath and how long he can reach his arms. Now, the arms thing, I'm not sure how that would apply, but it's Creed, and it seems like maybe he has a plan.
Nessie's in a hole, and Jim has to get her out.
That'd be a pretty large hole. Isn't it, like, big? That's what she said. Yeah, okay. All right, that was two that's what she says in a row, and I didn't even realize it. All right. Okay.
But if Jim can hold his breath long enough to get to Nessie's home, which is in a tunnel, he could pull her right out and give Creed all the riches in Scotland. Go ahead.
So, hang on. So far, we argued about what type of home the Loch Ness Monster lives in and how many nipples it has. Welcome to the Oddcast.
Brought to you by Yeet Trivia.
Yeet Trivia. Okay. Did you want to argue about the Loch Ness Monster? Or do you want to move on?
Well, I can say Creed is crazy enough to go and find Nessie. Unfortunately, he's in the wrong place. He already knows that Nessie has to be in Scotland because that's all the riches in Scotland. He's not going to find Nessie in Lake Wallenpaupack. So it seems a little crazy, which Creed is crazy, to be in Pennsylvania. And also, he's asking people to help him find Nessie. That seems a little crazier because he wants to find Nessie himself, in this theory at least. Unless he's going to pull a William Charles Schneider and just off them once they find Nessie and then he take all the credit. So you can't put much past Creed. It's very plausible. So why not?
So since you brought up William Charles Schneider, maybe you can confirm for me something that I heard on YouTube. And if this is true, then it's one of those things that years later, I am still finding things to laugh at this show. I heard that, okay, you know how Creed Bratton's real name is Creed Bratton? I heard that his real name is not Creed Bratton, that it's actually William Charles Schneider. Is that true? Have you heard this?
Yep. The actor Creed Bratton's given name, birth name, is William Charles Schneider. I assume maybe he changed it whenever he joined the grassroots. As much as I know, or for what I know about Creed, is that he was never supposed to have a role. He was just going to be a background character, and he spoke in an episode. And when you speak in an episode, you're no longer an extra. You must be credited. And I think this was mentioned in the Office Ladies podcast, but he basically accidentally became a cast member and became a recurring character. But whenever he asked, like, so what do I do? I don't have much of a script. They said, just be Creed Bratton. So William Charles Schneider, who changed his name to Creed Bratton, told the truth in a lot of the things that he said in the Talking Heads. He did say, William Charles Schneider and Creed Bratton, he talked about being with the grassroots. He talked about being a DJ. I'm not sure if that was a deleted scene or in canon. A little messed up on all of that. But he does mention all these things. He also talks about being with Squeaky Fromm, who was a member of the Manson family, and that was around the time that the grassroots were popular and that Creed was in the grassroots. So it's very possible that the actor Creed Bratton hung around with the Manson family, which would make him part of a cult, possibly as a leader or as a follower, making money, having fun. All of the things that the actor said as a character could very well be true.
I don't think that, I mean, was he probably involved in some cult shit at some time? Yeah, it was the 70s. Get off his nuts.
Now, let's not get too fangirlish over here, but I love the Beach Boys. And poor old Carl, and I believe it's just Carl, maybe Dennis Wilson, got in pretty tight with the Manson family. And they had leaders. There was another guy who actually performed a lot of the murders. He's the one that had killed Sharon Tate and the delivery guy that was lost or whatever. But yeah, Charles was not the only, like, he was the top, but he had, you know, he has one, and then there's three, and then they tell three, and then they tell three. It's not a pyramid scheme.
Like little murderous deacons?
Yeah, basically. I mean, why not? David Smith did it, or whatever his name was.
Wow, this whole thing took like a crazy turn just now. We got way off topic with the Manson family.
Now, there's another theory, and I'm only going to talk about one, but there are two theories. One is that Michael is secretly brilliant and he only acts like an idiot. And I think there's some things for and against that, but I personally think that Michael is a bit unintelligent, but mostly just a narcissist. We'll eventually get into that, I promise. We will talk about Michael Scott extensively. But right now, we'll talk about Kevin, who is supposedly financial genius acting as an idiot. This theory has been going on pretty much, since theories began, since fans were fans in the first place. I think this is one of the very first ones because, of course, we've got the Kalevin. And then whenever he talks with Martin about insider trading and how he won at poker, he bamboozled Daryl and Andy during Dallas. So he's got his wits about him. But I just don't think that he is intelligent or conniving enough to put on this facade for at least 9 years and fool everybody into thinking that he's an idiot. One of the biggest reasons is that he owns a bar after all of this is over with. He's no longer an accountant because he got fired for being a terrible accountant. So, A, come on now, that's smoking gun right there, but it is what it is. So there is a deleted scene. If you want to argue with me on this, whatever. Greg Daniels, Ken Klopfus both say deleted scenes are canon. But the way that Kevin got the bar was that people basically felt sorry for him and they bought him a beer and they would put it on their tab, but Kevin never drank the beer. So they couldn't necessarily charge him for it. And it wound up being, I think, 13 or 16, I think it's $13,000 in credit. So it was just cheaper for the bar owner to make him partner rather than pay him back $13,000 in beers. So that is a theory, but I do not think that Kevin is a genius. I think he is, in fact, a moron.
So we're gonna have to argue on this one. I actually love the Kevin is a genius theory. I love this. Now, you did bring up that deleted scene where he says how he got into the bar. But first of all, when Dwight comes into that bar during his bachelor party, I think Dwight says to him, "Hey, I heard that you bought a bar." And Kevin's like, "Yeah, this one. Bought a bar is very different from being made a partner. Secondly, if it's a bar doing that level of business, $13,000 does not make you a partner." So you also touched on, he talks about the insider trading thing. And as I was looking into this one, I don't think it's a deleted scene. I think it's one of the webisodes for the accountants. And there's $3,000 missing, right? And this whole time I'm watching this webisode in order to, collect gunfire for my Kevin is a genius argument. It turns out that Angela fucked up and that's where that went. But he's a nationally ranked poker player. I think that, oh, there's also a deleted scene where Kevin says that he had an IQ test when he was a child. And that his IQ was over 100. Now that's what he says. So, I mean, if it was 101, would Kevin say that? Yes. If it was 180, would Kevin say that? Also, yes. Also, the way he totally duped Andy and Daryl with Dallas, I think, was an absolute stroke of brilliance that normal Kevin, or the Kevin that they want us to think he is, I don't think Kevin would have been able to pull that off unless Kevin is not the Kevin that we think he is. So I really like this theory. I would like to believe that Kevin is a secret genius. And my main point on that is that a $13,000 bar tab does not make you a partner in a business like that, unless it was really failing. And even then, I don't think that would be the solution. So I'm gonna have to disagree with you. I like the Kevin is a genius theory, and I'm gonna go with that because it makes me happy.
So, all right, what is your next theory?
Okay, So this isn't even really a theory. It is something that someone brought up to me and I laughed so freaking hard at it that I have to put it in this podcast. Carol Stills is Steve Carell's real life wife. And at one point, the reason Carol breaks up with him is because he has photoshopped himself into a picture of her on a ski trip with her husband and her kids.
He was there with her in spirit.
Did he not then, if that was an actual picture from her life, did he not Photoshop a picture of himself over a picture of himself? Because if that was a real life picture, that could have been an actual picture from their family. And he put his own head over his own head. And I hope that is true.
Okay, I can tell you half of that theory is untrue. Those are most certainly not his children. Huh. The ages of his children do not match how old those children were at the time of the picture. His children are younger than the children in the picture. And as far as him photoshopping himself over himself, that could be true, because I am 95% certain that that is Carol standing next to a person whose face has been photoshopped over. So it's very possible that Steve Carell or whoever did the photoshopping took Steve Carell's face, put it over Steve Carell's face, made it a little bit bigger so that it looks like an expert at Photoshop did it. So unfortunately, those are 100% not his children, but that could be him with him over him.
So you burst my bubble a little bit there, Chris, and I'm going to try to get over it.
I do that a lot.
I'm going to try to.
You'll grow to hate me for it, so we'll see.
I'm gonna try to forgive you for what you just did to me, but that's okay, because that one was actually my favorite.
It's a good one.
I'm sure you've heard this one before. Angela and Roy.
Yes.
Okay, so here's my evidence. In that webisode we were talking about where there's $3,000 missing, they have to go through and like interview every person in the office. Yeah. And she adamantly, before they even interview him, defends Roy. She says he has too much character to do something like that. Obviously, Roy exhibits his interest when they're playing Who Would You Do? And he says that, what does he say?
Tight-ass Christian chick.
Yeah, the tight-ass Christian chick.
My name's Angela.
When they think they're losing their jobs, she says to Roy that he'll be fine because he's very strong and capable. And it seems like every time as we're going through that they have an interaction, Angela does get a little bit flustered.
Oh, gosh. Goodness.
Yes. Goodness. So, okay. So what do you think on the Angela Roy theory?
Well, there is another one that you didn't mention, and it's during the casino night whenever Michael does his welcome in, bienvenue. And he says that friends become lovers or whatever. Well, it goes from Angela to Roy. And so it seems as if the camera crew has picked up on it, or at least they want to lead you to believe that there might be something there. My thoughts are that Angela has a crush on Roy, that Roy does find Angela to be attractive, but they have never actually done anything. Maybe, maybe not, but it seems like Angela is more schoolgirly crush. And Roy's just kind of like, yeah, tap that, I guess. So they don't necessarily act as if they have been together. Just simply there's a little office crush between the two.
I will agree that Angela seems a bit schoolgirlish about it. Whereas with Dwight, she's definitely not that. And we know she has an interest in Dwight. So I can see that, I think. All right, I'll agree with you on that one. Okay, so I have...
My turn.
Is it your turn? Do you have another one?
I do actually have one more that I didn't think about the first time. Okay, now there is a theory, and it involves several different people with Phyllis. It's about the one-night stand and who Phyllis might have had the one-night stand with in the office.
I know.
I have one scene or quote, I guess, that I feel solidifies my decision for who it is. Many people think that it's Stanley, because Stanley is known to have had affairs and he does have interracial relationships. Terry, we know, is white. Then there's the idea of Jim, which as far as I know is only because of whenever she says, even one night stands, it pans over to Jim and he goes, wow. Some people have interpreted that as kind of a wow of guilt. I think it's just, wow, the audacity to say that right here. My best guess for who it is, and that, I mean, it never actually says that she did have a one-night stand with anybody, but we assume that she did. And my best guess is that it was Todd Packer, because when Michael was talking about them being salesmen together, he said that Todd Packer had banged everybody in the office or in the bullpen. And Phyllis has been working at Dunder Mifflin for quite some time. So just to summarize, Packer is Phyllis's one night, and I will die on that hill.
I think it's Stanley. I really do, because I feel like, I mean, with the exception of the time that Stanley complains about her, right, when they're reading all the complaints from everybody in the office, they're really close, and he makes her that cute little bird, Phyllis, and then she's, you know, at, what is it, the last show, they're, she's trying to fatten up the new Stanley, right? I wholeheartedly believe it's Stanley, because I think they would both keep quiet about it. And we didn't, I mean, yes, they panned to Jim when she says that, but we didn't see Stanley's face. And for all we know, he was crawling under his desk.
All right, so those who can't be swayed at all and think that Toby is a Scranton Strangler, go ahead and end this podcast now. Because we're going to tell you that you are wrong. Toby is not the Scranton Strangler. Before we get into it, also, Creed is not the Scranton Strangler. Yes, he showed up with blood on him. Yes, he probably did murder people, but he's not the Scranton Strangler. No, Jim is not the Scranton Strangler. The evidence for that is even more flimsy than the Toby one. No, Andy is not the Scranton Strangler. No, Gabe is not the Scranton Strangler. Gabe does not have the lung capacity to blow a whistle. He most certainly could not strangle somebody. So I don't know if you can put this up there, but we do have proof that the writers have said George Howard Scubb is the Scranton Strangler. And I guess, do you want to just fire off what people say is the reason for Toby being the Scranton Strangler? We can roll our eyes and then just dismiss it.
Here's the evidence. The very incorrect and flimsy and terrible evidence for Toby being the Scranton Strangler. When the office employees are watching the standoff between the police and the Scranton Strangler, and then later they chase him, Toby isn't there. Furthermore, in that same scene, they're watching it at Toby's desk. And at one point, a phone call comes through straight to Toby's desk. Aaron is not at reception to put that phone call through. So presumably, it's someone who knows Toby, knows his extension, and possibly is calling him to say, hey, is that your car? Also, at one point, we can see, I think it's during parkour, we can see that same green car that the police are chasing in the parking lot of the Scranton Business Park. And also, I guess the last one would be Toby's incessant need to overturn the verdict that he helped give, right? He's really obsessed with this. And that could be explained if he were the Scranton Strangler, then he would be dealing with some guilt. Let me start with, if he were the Scranton Strangler, he would not be dealing with guilt over that. Just saying.
Yeah, very unlikely.
So do you want to debunk that a little further?
Well, there are several times when Toby is not in the office. We're not quite sure what he's over, but he's obviously over the Scranton branch. There are times where it kind of alludes that he to the idea that he could be over other branches. But we do know that he goes back and forth from Scranton to New York at least. So he could very easily be dealing with something in New York or with another branch he's over. So it's not uncommon for him to be in his office. It also wouldn't be uncommon for his phone to ring. For one thing, it's possible that, I don't know, corporate HR called him to ask an HR question, or as many businesses do, if nobody answers the reception phone after, say, six rings, it'll go over to another phone. Who better to go to than the not as busy HR rep? So him not being there does not make him the strength.
Yeah,
his phone ringing.
Let me expand on that for a second, because not only, I mean, you're saying that if Aaron didn't answer the phone, then they could have put themselves through the system to go to HR. Or since Aaron's sitting in the back with everybody, she could have programmed the phone to just ring to the back. And that was just the original line ringing. And Kelly now, didn't want to hear it.
Do we trust Aaron's intelligence level to do that?
Well, she could not turn off the speakerphone without sitting on it. So no.
But like I said, I mean, at the company for which I work, if nobody answers the front phone, it automatically pushes to a different phone that's more likely to be the second answer. So it's not uncommon for something like that to happen. Or they could have, you know, nobody is there. If you know your party's extension, please press doo-doo-doo, and then they press doo-doo-doo. So there are so many reasons why that phone could have rang. None of them makes sense that Toby called his own phone. That's one of the theories, is that he called his own phone from the car during the chase for what? Yeah, I know. I'm telling you, these are the theories that they have. So not uncommon for him to be out of his office, not uncommon for his phone to ring. The next one, what was it, the cars?
The cars, and on this one, there are five businesses at least in that building. It's not completely outside of the realm of possibility that the Scranton Strangler happened to be visiting the business park that day. Not to mention, that's the only time we see that car. If that was Toby's car, wouldn't we have seen it at least once before or once after?
Or the fact that there's more than that one of that type of car in the city of Scranton.
So in a crazy scheme to make money, maybe they made more than one of those cars.
Yeah, it's just, it's unreal to think otherwise.
Yes, it's obnoxious.
Another one, I don't think you mentioned it though, is that he's got the Chad Flinderman novel. So what? Toby likes crime novels, but there's nothing wrong with that. I like crime novels. I like looking up serial killers. I am not a serial strangler.
His main character that he's obsessed with solves crimes. He doesn't create them. He solves them. He's a detective. He's a fan of the hard
over-sexualized black detective.
Just saying.
Then there's, of course, the one where once Toby and Jim are talking about Jim's marriage, Clark, I believe, walks through and he like, get out of here. And he's like, I'll kill him. Okay. I don't know about you, but I have uttered the words, I'll kill you, I'll kill him at some point in my life. I have yet to murder anybody.
Yeah, I think that was definitely more about he really wanted to hear about the end of Jim and Pam. Like, that was very important to him. And I don't think, I mean, Jesus, how many times has Dwight talked about different ways to murder people? Is Dwight the Scranton Strangler too? Also,
to his chickens, he is.
I totally forgot about that. Oh, well, let's go with that. Dwight also dressed up as the Scranton Strangler. Let's use that as some flimsy evidence for a ridiculous theory. Let's not forget the biggest piece of frickin' evidence that when he went to visit the Scranton Strangler, he strangled him.
Oh, see, the theorist would say that that's poetic justice and that the person who was convicted of the stranglings strangled Toby, who is a Scranton Strangler, as revenge for Toby putting him behind bars.
The theorists need to take several seats. okay? Because that is ridiculous.
Yes, I'm sorry to tell you guys, Toby is not the Scranton Strangler. The evidence that you want to call evidence is at best circumstantial and consequential. But it's really like, please don't ever become detectives for anything in law enforcement. Please, for the love of God.
Yeah, that's, don't quit your day job. That being said, if after you have listened to our whole debunking and basically just griping about people thinking other things than us, if you have a really good argument and you really want to talk to us about it, write me an email to yeettrivia@gmail.com, yeettrivia@gmail.com, and I will read it. And if it actually gives me some new information, I will talk about it again. I don't want to, but you can force me to if you would like. Hey, everybody, be sure to check out our very favorite Facebook group, The Office Revisited. And for a little extra meme love on your Insta feed, check out the_OfficeInstaFans.
If you are a fan of The Office and you think you know your stuff, check out Yeet Trivia, Y-E-E-T Trivia, where they have weekly trivia for The Office specifically. They have prizes for first, second, and third place. And if you don't place, there's a raffle, so you could get another free ticket to do trivia again or any other nifty gifties that we might be able to provide. That is Yeet Trivia. You can find it on Facebook and Eventbrite.